Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. And by the Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1, my new book, featuring over 45 intimate conversations with the greatest music legends the world will ever know. Available now at bookbaby.com and amazon.com. Buy now for the holidays. It's a great gift. People from all walks of life have been affected by the music of the Beatles. They gave the world inspiration and happiness in almost everything they did. October 9th marked the 80th anniversary of John Lennon's birthday. And to commemorate that, a new music video was released honoring John Lennon. John Lennon, A Day in His Life. Grammy-nominated American producer Michael Franklin and Beatles animator Alvaro Ortega teaming up to create it. The spark of Lennon's tribute began when Franklin awoke from a dream in which he dreamt of the Lennon song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. While hearing John's voice singing A Day in the Life, amazed by the similarity between the two songs, chord sequences, and lyrics, Franklin hurriedly put this combination to the piano the next night. Another similar dream awakening him again. This time, the Baroque piano solo bridge sped up to sound like a harpsichord dashed off by my father, Sir George Martin, for John's song In My Life from Rubber Soul while the Beatles were on a lunch break. John Lennon, A Day in His Life is Franklin's montage of some of the most memorable moments we love from the Beatles songs. John's vocals superimposed over a cleverly stitched together visual collage, the tribute based on an original score from the Sgt. Pepper's album. Franklin said, "I realized the same chord progressions are in Eleanor Rigby as well as other Beatles songs. It was quite a surprise and I couldn't stop thinking about what the Beatles did. I drove right in exploring other Beatles song bites. The music production took about 3 weeks to research, edit, and arrange." And that's a remarkable feat in itself. After completion of the tribute track, it was time to synchronize the video. Franklin had been aware of Ortega's unique animations of the Beatles for several years, skillfully editing on his laptop previous bit and pieces of Ortega's works, demonstrating to him what could be done, reaching out to Ortega in Spain, Ortega happily agreeing, the rest now history. A tribute to John Lennon, a new music video, A Day in His Life. This unique musical and visual tribute has been created with deep, heartfelt, loving care for one of the greatest musicians of all time, George Paul Martin. Michael Franklin, a Grammy-nominated musician and producer, has worked performing, producing for myriad of legendary musicians as a musician with Brian Wilson, Paul McCartney, Joe Walsh, Bruce Hornsby, members of the Stones, Yes, Toto, the Moody Blues, and many others. As a music director for television, Hard Rock Live, Wolfman Jack TV show, NBC, CBS, Comcast, and concert specials. And as a record producer, Reggae Tribute, Larry Coryell, John Anderson, Rick Wakeman, Pat Travers, Blues Image, Patrick Mraz, and many others. His most recent production, the highly acclaimed album with John Anderson of Yes, 1,000 Hands, Chapter 1, released worldwide on Blue Elan Records. He's currently in production on a new album for Robbie Steinhardt, the original vocalist and violinist for the band Kansas. Vero Ortega, recognized worldwide for his popular Beat Tunes as animated series, has parodied the Fab Four cartoons, have been enjoyed by millions for many years in video and in print worldwide. Please welcome producer, composer, performer, Michael Franklin to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Michael.
Hi there, Ray. Pleasure to be with you.
It's nice for you to be here. It's really amazing. I really, really enjoy the tribute music video you put together, and I can't believe you guys did that so quickly as well.
Well, sometimes the best stuff comes pretty quick. I mean, I work in both parameters. One, things come quickly, or things take a long time to make perfect. You know, there's never twain shall meet.
Exactly. But it was very well put together. I've enjoyed the Beat Tunes. As a matter of fact, I got turned on to that by my daughter, because she was showing those cartoons to my grandkids, and they love those. But it's done so well. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, I saw when I finished the Lennon tribute, or I was just close to finishing it, I had seen a art exhibit by a guy named Michael Ojekrenier.
Mm-hmm.
He does Beatle artwork.
Right.
Very, very good. Like really Dali-ish type stuff. And it all incorporates the Beatles. But I got together with him, and I was thinking about maybe trying to do something with his paintings and seeing if I could do something with that. But he didn't have that many. He only had like four paintings, so I didn't think it would be that interesting. And I was aware of Ortega's stuff, so what I did is I just got my phone and I took different pictures of some Ortega's things, and I edited them together, and I sent them to him and said, here's my piece, and this is what I think. You know, you've got this vast reservoir of Beatle footage and different things that I know you have. And he agreed to do it, which was great. And it really did make, you know, people see things. They see music sometimes through their eyes. So it helped the musical piece.
Well, the way you synchronize the various, Lennon tracks was pretty amazing. Because they do sound similar, and they kind of meshed together very, very well.
Well, I mean, there's a couple tricks, and there's a couple allusions in it. You know, I mean, like, I had to change the keys of some of the songs to make it work. But
right.
Generally, a lot of people use the same motors and chord progressions in their work. And, Lennon really used that, you know, one major seven, relative minor nine to many, many songs. And so but a lot of people do. You know, you can find out where a lot of people use some of the same chord things. And at the time, they were very much into the folk thing. So, I mean, if you're a guitar player, which I was, I'm mm-hmm. more of a keyboard player now, but, you know, I sort of saw what he was playing, and that vision is in a lot of Beatles songs. So there was a thread there I knew I could work, you know.
You know, as a producer, engineer, you gotta really admire the way they recorded music back in the 60s, because they didn't have all the technology they had now, and the sound was just so darn clear, you know, and you had that echo effect, you know, kind of in the background from all those 60, 45 records. And, even songs like Tomorrow Never Knows, the way they did that, you know, to me that was amazing for that time. And, you know,
well, they were lucky in a sense. I mean, I was just listening to an interview this morning by someone, and it was, at the time, everything was new. I mean, electronics, the whole idea of different type of sound reproduction was all very new. So it was wide open, and I think for them to be, associated with somebody like George Martin, whose son Gregory wrote that beautiful intro mm-hmm. for A Day in His Life, they're very lucky to have somebody who is not only musically inclined, but also is ready to accept all the new modern electronic innovations. You know, some producers weren't, you know.
What is George Martin's son doing right now? What is he doing?
His son Gregory is more of a writer and literary producer. And I think he's working on some new television series. We have a mutual friend who shared it with him, and that's how I got that response, you know. So, it's great that somebody who's that close to the Beatles could, give me some sort of support. I do know many other famous musicians that are within my circle have all heard it and given it a lot of praise. It was only done really just for me. There's no monetary, I had no vision
right.
that it would get big. It was just something I wanted to do in between finishing up the John Anderson album and virtually almost finishing up the Robbie Steinhardt album. I was just working on a few things. You know, my brain needs food. Just say that.
I understand that. you guys in the music biz, man, you can't stay idle. That's impossible. And I know this pandemic is killing you guys.
Actually, I want to say, I don't want to get anybody upset, but it's just the opposite for me.
Really?
I have a nice tract of land in Orlando on a private lake.
Right.
And I have three houses.
Oh, wow.
One's my brother, who's my closest friend and bass player. And then my studio's in between, and then there's my house. And we're very isolated. It's like a 7-foot-high brick fence all the way around this place on three sides and a lake on the other side.
Sounds great.
So we're very isolated. But during this time period, it's almost like the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't much do anything else. All the live gigs have been canceled. So, you know, we're just hunkering down and doing music, and luckily for the internet, a lot of my musical people are all sending me stuff. Like, you know, I got some music from Bruce Hornsby the other day, and I'm working on some of that. And I got some music from Rick Derringer and Patrick Mraz. And, you know, people send me stuff either towards a project I'm working on or as something for a new project. So, you know, it's really good.
So you're busy, yeah. Yeah, I've been very busy because everybody's home, and so it's a lot easier to get interviews.
Yeah, sure. You know, the studio's basically been running constantly
mm-hmm.
because people who are smart are putting their resources into doing some product
right.
once we get over this, you know. So
talk a little bit about Franklin Music Group. I went out to your website and it sounds like you got your hands into a lot of different things there with the studio.
I'm pretty much all over the place.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to say that I'm scattered, but you know, my life isn't just music. The music production thing has been really great for me, but you know, I lived in China for 14 years. After I did a lot of musical stuff. I was a music director on TV for Wolfman Jack for
right,
years.
Right.
Played with hundreds of groups. Had the Rolodex from hell when a Rolodex was a Rolodex.
Mm-hmm.
And so we toured with everybody. We were, from being on the TV show, we would meet with different friends and they would say, hey, look, we're coming down to Florida or the Southeast. You know, we're going to use you as the band. So, I mean, I've been the Birds, I've been the Animals, I've been Herman's Hermits, I've been Survivor, I've been Kansas, I've
right.
been, you know, whatever. Whoever wants my group of guys to work with them, and we would get the stuff and we would nail it and go on the road. But then about in 2000, when I got the music director of Hard Rock, from about 1998 till about 2003, I got a mission going over to Japan to do write music for Hello Kitty.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went there, I got my first taste of China, and then I went to China for some music and entertainment-related things to do the cartoons for Felix the Cat.
Right.
And I fell in love with the whole thing of China. Music was falling off the rails here. It was the time of the Backstreet Boys and all that kind of stuff. So it was sort of like the end of what I was doing and then the beginning of something else. I went over there and started working with Chinese artists and then got involved in business. You know, not to get off the beaten path of this is a musical interview, but I invented the solar chargers for iPhone and iPad.
I saw that.
A bunch of other solar stuff.
Yeah.
Hence Solar Studios, right?
That's so incredible.
I have a solar company in China. And
right.
We do solar all over the world. So it helps me with my recording addiction.
Definitely. What's the music scene like in China?
It's pretty cool. You know, the people there are really into music.
Mm-hmm.
They really love music. Everybody's singing. Everybody's, trying to learn how to play instruments. There's a street in Beijing called Shintandi.
Right.
And on that street, on the far north side of the city, there's probably 200 music stores.
Hmm.
And just like in some cities, like you go to New York, there's like the clothing district, the diamond district,
yeah,
whatever. In Beijing, there's the Shintandi, there's the music district. And there's so many musical instruments, because 90% of them are made in China anyway.
Exactly.
That there's boxes out into the street with tarps over them, of drum sets and guitar amps. And in the last, I'll say, 6 or 7 years, they've gotten turned on to rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
Before, it was pop kind of stuff. I mean, there was sort of a little bit of 80s-type pop ballads that were, you know, that were really popular there. Chinese people sing them, not any Western artists.
Mm-hmm.
No Western. Unlike Japan or Philippines, who really knew Toto and Yes,
yes
and Kansas
right.
and stuff like this.
Right.
And the Beatles. China, no.
Huh.
Just no. I mean, I remember being on the phone one time with McCartney's manager, and I was trying to bring McCartney to China, because I was working with the Ministry of Culture there, and the Chinese didn't even know who McCartney was.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Let It Be was sung by Hallam Yu, but Yesterday was done by Coco Lee, you know, like that. They love the songs, but they wouldn't know a Beatle to come and bit them up on the butt.
Is that because of the communist thing? Because I know Russia, they know everybody. I mean, you know, big rock bands have played Russia.
Yeah, lot of it was, the Cultural Revolution
right.
Really suppressed a lot of things. But what happened is, I think when, you probably don't know your Chinese history, like most Americans don't, but I think during, after Deng Xiaoping mm-hmm. sort of opened up China a little bit,
right.
If people started hearing music, and, I mean, here's a funny one. If you go to China, here's the popular songs of China. Hotel California.
Really?
Right Here Waiting for You by Richard Marx.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Only You by the Platters.
How about that?
Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by the Platters. Because there was a young Chinese movie
uh-huh.
of people going to the karaoke bar, which is where the Chinese kids go to socialize.
Right, you know, right.
They don't have their own houses. They all go to a karaoke bar, and that's where they meet each other, have dates, and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So it's a story about a young kid who learns the Platters songs, which is funny because I work with all the original Platters.
Yep.
You know, so those songs are very, very popular in the U.S. And one of the most popular songs is a song written by a very close friend of mine, Jerry Allison.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that name?
Sounds familiar. If you name the song,
J.I. Allison is the drummer for Buddy Holly and the Crickets.
Okay, yeah, I know the Crickets. Yep.
Okay. So I produced the Crickets years ago, and
okay.
J.I. Allison was one of my close friends.
Right.
And he wrote a song a long time ago called Whoa, Whoa, Yeah, Yeah, Love You More Than I Can Say.
Mm-hmm.
It was done by Buddy Holly. It was also covered by Leo Sayers and Linda Ronstadt. It's been a hit many times. But the Chinese, for some reason during the Vietnam War, they heard that song, and it has a pentatonic scale like Chinese music. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, right?
Right.
You hear that song all over China, everywhere, and elevators. I went to a place where, like, you know, we have our Preservation Hall jazz band, you know, the 90-year-old, 80-year-old guys who are playing jazz. jazz in New Orleans.
Right.
They have their own version of it. And I went there, and they were playing Love You More Than I Can Say. And afterwards, I went and I talked to the guys. I speak decent Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy told me, no, that's an ancient Chinese song. And I recorded it, and I sent it to J.I., and he just died laughing. You know, they think it's a Chinese song.
That's funny.
Because they've been hearing it for 50 years.
Yeah.
More than that, since the Vietnam War, you know, the 60s.
That's amazing. I never knew that about China. I never knew that.
It's amazing. I played on some records over there.
Uh-huh.
And I did a lot of big concerts with people. And it's really great because they really, really do love music and NBA.
Oh, yeah. we know that. Dennis Rodman.
So there you go. That's China in a nutshell.
Yeah. Well, I got a good stock from China. I got NIO stock, you know, the electric car that's taken off. It's do you have any of that stock, NIO?
No, actually, I have a different one. It's called BMD. It's Build Your Own Dream.
Okay.
So that's the number one electric car company in China. All the taxi cabs and all the municipal people have that. Build Your Own. It's a beautiful car.
How much is it trading for?
Actually, I have not checked in a while.
Okay.
But the price of the car, they're supposed to bring that car to the United States.
Oh, really?
You know, I do have an electric car. I have a Nissan Leaf.
Wow, nice.
But there's a story behind it. My friend has a $125,000 Tesla. One of my partners in one of my business.
Uh-huh.
And I bought this car for my wife for $10,000.
Really?
And with 7,000 miles on it and a 100,000 mile warranty.
Wow.
And you know what? His car now, you can get that car for $69,000, and that's what he owes on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had this car for 5 years, and I've never done anything to it. And my solar system on here charges the car every day. It's my wife's car.
That's funny. Yeah, they got some nice electric cars over there. I mean, the NIO brand, they got some gorgeous cars, you know?
Right. Yeah. They do. I mean, because they are truly trying to find a way. I mean, in a sense, I can defend the Chinese all day about some of the stuff they do because the solar company that I'm dealing with is doing projects all over the country.
Yep, you're making money.
They are trying their hardest to solve the pollution problem because it's pretty bad.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, with 10 times the people we have, if you can imagine.
Yeah. Them in Mexico City, for sure.
Yeah.
Another place that is polluted.
I lived in a city in China called Xiamen, Xiamen.
Right.
Which is the musical city of China. It's where the Mulongyu Music Conservatory is. There's a whole island that all the music conservatories are on. And they build pianos there, and mostly guitars in China are built there. I import a lot of guitars for the Oriolo Guitar Company down there. And, you know, it's amazing. No one's ever heard of the city, and it's only got like 5 million people in it.
Hmm. Yeah, we're not, it's hard to get information about China just because it's kind of closed off, you know?
Recently it is because of the COVID.
Yeah.
Normally, I got like a 10-year visa, so I can go in and out, you know, whenever, because I got family there. I'm married to a Chinese lady.
Okay.
Who's a pianist, you know, so, we haven't been able to go back. I normally go back about 3 times a year because I have family and friends there and business.
Sounds like a tough language to learn, though. Am I right or not really?
You know what? It's not as, it depends on like if it's Mandarin or Cantonese. I don't think Mandarin is as difficult as Cantonese.
Right.
There's only 4 tones to it, but it's almost like English. It's almost like word replacement. You know, so if you learn all the vocabulary in China, you can say it properly with the diphthongs. You know, every different syllable has a different kind of scoop to it. You know, but if you learn that, you can virtually. I found myself being able to put sentences together and actually communicate with people of things I've never said before by word replacement. Now, I believe I do sound like Yoda to them. time. And
oh, they appreciate
really
that.
Hunker down to learn a Chinese.
They're shocked. I saw there's a guy on YouTube, young white guy, and he speaks like perfect Chinese and Mandarin, and also like the ancient Chinese. And when he starts talking, I mean, everybody is quiet. Like, the whole restaurant shuts up and listens to this guy. Because they're shocked that, you know, he takes the time to learn the language, you know?
Yeah, and if you're a tall, blonde kind of guy, and you
yeah.
talk Mandarin, I mean, there's nothing you can't do in China. You know, they really like Europeans. You know, they really like
right.
French and German mm-hmm. and everything European. But they do love America. That's the things people don't understand. I mean, the actual word for America is Meitei.
Right.
It means beautiful place.
Well, you can't blame country. The people are so much different than their governments. You know what I mean? So, you know, the people are people. You know, they appreciate us, and we appreciate them. It's just when governments interfere, that's when it changes the whole ball game. You know?
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. I gotta say, man, 1,000 hands is an incredible project. And how did you put that thing together? Because you got what a list of music celebs on that. It's amazing.
Well, I think from all my years being a music director, a backup band leader, you know, for all the people that came through.
Right.
You know, I developed a lot of relationships with a lot of different people. And when the project first came to me, this was in the 90s, actually, when at the time my friend Brian Chatton had lived in Orlando,
mm-hmm.
and that he moved away to California and asked me would I, you know, help him out putting some orchestration on these tunes that he was writing with John. And then, you know, I got him. I did my first orchestrations of them. I think it was like 4 songs. I sent them off to John. He liked it. I flew up to California and met with him. And then, I got my music directorship to do something, and then he was on the road with like Yes or Qatar or something like that. It was like, okay, I guess we're not going to do it. So I just let it lie, and I figured maybe eventually won't get it together again. You know, I had produced Wakeman's album, and mm-hmm. I produced Patrick's album. And I figured, okay, you know, eventually. So, I don't know what it was. I was working with Iron Butterfly. I was playing a concert with Iron Butterfly, and we were doing the Bakersfield Music Festival in California, and I just
right.
said, you know, I'm not too far away from where John is,
mm-hmm.
so let me reach out and see if we can get together. At least my wife had never been to California, so we're going to fly to Bakersfield, mm-hmm. play the show, and then drive around through California a little bit before we come home. So that's what we did. We met John up at his place, you know, and we talked about doing the album, and he agreed, and then he sent me the 24 tracks that he had in his garage. And then when I got them, you know, I had them baked and put to digital, and I started working on it,
mm-hmm.
and it was mostly the stuff I had done before wasn't there. These were the original tapes. I got, like, a mixtape, and then I put stuff over it, so... But here I had the basic things. And then I started thinking about it, and I wanted to, you know, make it sound expensive. I'll say that.
Right.
He didn't like the synthesizers that were on it because
uh-huh.
it made it sound dated. And for me, I'm an orchestrator, so
right.
I want to hear a synthesizer for a synthesizer part. Or the whole thing is synthesizer. You know, I mean, it depends on who you're working with. So I started arranging it, and I think I was doing a session with Larry Coryell,
mm-hmm.
a jazz guitar player.
Sure.
He was doing a new album in the studio. I was producing it, and I said, "Hey, Larry, you know, because there was a synthesizer guitar part on one of the first songs." I said, "Larry, why don't you play some guitar on this?" And he said, "Yeah, sure." And he whipped it off, and it was like, "Wow, man, that made it sound good." And my idea was I was going to start to replace everything,
mm-hmm.
you know, with real instruments or something that was similar. And then Larry played on a couple more tunes, and then I reached out to Ian Anderson, and he put a flute on it. And then it just started to get over there. I mean, I had the design of doing that anyway, but how it all started, because I, Luke John says I'm like a casting director.
Right.
I heard, okay, you know what would sound great there is this.
Right.
And so you reach out to people, like Tower of Power was doing a session on one of my songs. Mm-hmm. I put Tower of Power on a couple of John's songs. One's on Chapter 1, one might be on Chapter 2. You know. So, and so on. So, I mean, if you go down the list of names, Steve Morris from Dixie Dregs and Deep Purple, he's also on the Robbie album.
Yep.
And Billy Cobham, who's doing one of my tunes, he played on Come Up.
I know Billy.
And he's also on the Robbie album.
Yep.
So, some of the people that were here during the session, I put them on a couple different things that I thought they fit. And, you know, it just went on and on and on. And so, you know, I had everybody from Zap Mama, who was a favorite of John's, and I knew that, so I reached out to Maria, and I had her sing on it, and John was really happy with that.
Yeah.
You know, the music of Yes, was really part of my DNA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my brother and I, the first band we ever played in, we played Heart of the Sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So, it was that. It was trying to... working with John gives you the ability to not do anything normal. You know,
right.
Try to look for something innovative. You know, because that's what he's always trying to invent different things. And so the farther out I went, the more he liked it. So it was like, okay, I have the orders to just, you know, go crazy. So we went on and on with the original songs that were there, and then a couple other songs that he sent me. Didn't really have any music, they were just vocals, and that became Llama Llama, which is probably one of the most well-received on the record.
Right.
And I did that one, and I just had a couple people play on it, just the violinist, and Carmen Apice played drums on it, and my brother played bass. And then John said, God, I need a banjo player on that. And I thought for a minute, you know, I got this country session coming up, so... I stuck the banjo player on it, and it was great. I mean, his suggestion that somebody would have said, no, that'll never work, you know, it actually really worked well. So, him coming up, giving me something, or me writing something and throwing it back at him, because, you know, he has sort of a routine. I mean, maybe not just for trying to keep his instrument, you know, going, but he does a lot of, like singing in the morning and just singing patterns and stuff, trying to keep his voice, you know. And with that, he comes up with a lot of great ideas, and one of them was Where the Music Comes From. And that one, I mean, I know he tells the story. It's he sent it to me. I was on my way to Vietnam.
Really?
And he sent it to me, and I got it just like, I don't know, 5:30 in the morning before I was supposed to take like a 7:30 flight.
Right.
So I got it, and I downloaded it to my computer, and then when I got on the airplane, I'm thinking, you know, okay, great, Jet Lag City's going to come up, so let me work out something to get real tired. So I dove into the song, and 14 hours later, there's the song.
Hmm.
You know, everything he sang, I put all the instruments on it, I landed in Hong Kong, I sent it back to him, he said, loved it, I mixed it when I got home.
Wow.
That was it.
That was it, huh?
Yeah, that song is just me and him.
Huh. Well, that's a wonderful collaboration. I mean, that's not easy to do, you know, that quickly, and everybody's happy. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, the thing is, he gives me a lot of things to think about, and I can't make it really, really plain.
Right.
You know, so I'm just trying to, you know, I think I know what he likes, because, I mean, I like... I listen to his music.
Yep.
I like his music. I mean, Elias of Sinhala was like a Bible to me, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's how it all started. And, you know, he's a very, very unique artist and singer. I mean, what can you do? I mean, when you hear him, nobody can mistake it, you know.
I love John. I've had him on the show several times. As a matter of fact, I just had Rick Wakeman on the show not long ago. And, and I'm friends with Patrick Mraz. I think, believe it, lives here in Clearwater.
No, he lives down in Venice.
Oh, is he in Venice now? I didn't know that.
He's been down there for several years.
Okay.
He just played on one of Robbie's tunes just last week.
Yeah, he's very close to me then. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I went down to visit him a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. And we went out to Italian, and we came back to his studio. He had two grand pianos, and we filmed a thing called Too Much Pasta.
Patrick's
wonderful. I produced a Windows of Time.
Right.
And that was, quite an ordeal. I mean, it's just a solo piano album, but I mean, right from the very beginning, he stayed in one of my houses that had a grand piano in it.
Oh, he's an amazing artist.
Worked on the whole thing, from beginning to end. It was really great, yeah, and well received.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know. He was actually in the studio with, what's his name? The artist, over in Spain.
Oh, Salvador Dali.
Dali, yeah. He was actually in the studio. You know, not many people were allowed in the studio while he's painting and that kind of thing.
Well, I got another story that Petra told me about Salvador Dali.
Okay.
But he said he had to play for, Dali at a party.
Right.
So he says, okay, great. So he went to the party and the piano was up in a tree.
It sounds like him.
He had climbed up the tree to play the piano. He was up in a tree playing the piano for the guests. So, that's pretty wild.
That's crazy. That's something Keith Emerson, I would imagine, doing, but...
Yeah, you know, one of the unfortunate things about it, you know, I produced one for Wakeman, I produced one for Mraz, and then I was working on... I met Keith Emerson years ago when I played the British Music Fair, and he was really nice to me, invited me to come down to his house.
Yeah, he was a good guy.
That's a whole story in itself, because I was thinking, oh my God, you know, at the time, Emerson was my favorite keyboard player, and he wants me to come down to his house. So so I think, heck, look, I'm not going to do this other thing. I'm going to rent a car, and I'm going to drive down to where he lived, like down near Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over, and I thought, what the heck, why not rent a Jaguar? So I did. I went over to the place, and I rented a Jaguar, and then I got down there, and oh my God, the gear shift is on the wrong side, and the steering wheel is on the wrong side. Somebody couldn't do this. So anyway, I said, okay, come on, get it together. So I drove out, and as soon as I came up the basement where all the cars were, and I came up to the street, I almost got hit by a bus.
Oh,
I pulled the thing around and said, oh God, I can't do it. So I took the train.
Oh gosh.
Yep. But Keith was really gracious, was a nice guy, and he sent me a letter, I have it on a fax, something that was really, you know, nice. I had reached out to him to work on John's album, unfortunately, and we know what happened.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. If you go to the Wikipedia for Keith Emerson, there's a lot about my interview with him about the flying piano, you know, at California Jam. He told me all about that, and somebody printed it on Wikipedia.
Well, that's cool. I mean, that guy truly was, a great artist. He's probably my favorite, even though I think Patrick is, as far as his improvisational skills, Patrick is hardly to be matched in the rock classical world. Yeah.
You know, Patrick doesn't get enough credit, man. He's, you know, my favorite album from Yes was Relayer. You know, and he was the main, you know, he was the guy from Relayer and the Gates of Delirium and all that. And of course, he went on with the Moody Blues as well. I mean, he was a, you know, great artist. Really is.
Well, you know, I mean, to me, Patrick's best work, of course, is Story of I or, you know, Out in the Sun. You know, he's recorded a couple. I mean, he's a very lyrical kind of guy. Mm-hmm. He's kind of has a European sense to the piano, like a Debussy or something, you know, what he plays.
Right.
And I did a little show here in Orlando last year. I invited him to come up and play at this art theater called Blue Bamboo. And he came and played solo piano. It was just really wonderful. I mean, the place was packed with, Yes guys and Moody Blues people, but, he is an underrated artist and, you know, he could do what he wants to do. He's just playing on orchestra pieces, and then he just did a a really nice version of a Gentle Giant tune. I can't remember the name of the song, but it's just very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
With the London Symphony Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
Just wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, I love Gentle Giant.
Mean with Kindness.
Right.
From Gentle Giant. What a great song. That would, from a really great album, The Octopus, which is probably their best.
Excellent. Yeah. So what are you doing with Robbie Steinhardt? I know Robbie was messing around with the band Stormbringer, right? For a while.
Yeah, I mean, Stormbringer is a really good, a classic rock band in the Tampa area.
Yep.
In fact, the guitar player, Rick Moon, is probably, one of the reasons why I got to meet Robbie, because I sent out some thing. I wanted Robbie to play on something for John.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first off, I knew he was around the area, and, I wanted to work with him. I never met him before. And then Rick Moon from Stormbringer got Robbie's attention to come over. So they came over, and Robbie played on John's Activate Me, and then another tune of mine called Climb to Grace. We sort of hit it off really good. I mean, Robbie's a pretty interesting character. And so we started talking, and, he'd come over here, we'd go out to dinner, and,
mm-hmm.
and I sort of said, hey, you know what? I have an idea for a concept. And I put the concept together, and he was a little bit questioning it. But then, when it started to get off the ground, and my brother and I put some songs together and put it into the format, he got excited about it. So I said, look, we're going to do a project together. And that project is now, taking about a year, because sometimes my stuff takes a little while because I have so many things to do.
Right.
And if I depend on artists to come to, my 1,000 hands is sort of my brand. I've always done these big, cast of thousands kind of projects, So, I have 5 drummers on the record, five or six different guitar players, horn section, more, and sometimes it takes a while for them to, clear their schedule, come to the party, send you something. So I'm still waiting on a few pieces. I'm probably 90% done with the record. And we have a tour next year. We had a tour this year, which I'm sort of glad it didn't happen because it gave me more time to make the album better.
So what direction is the album taking? I mean, what is it? What will it kind of sound?
Oh, I'm telling you, man. I have played it for 3 or 4 people in the know.
Right.
And they are just so excited about it. The whole concept of it, the playing on it, it's virtually a concept piece. It's like there are separate songs, but then again, it's put together as a one giant piece.
Is it kind of is it kind of prog, or what do you think?
It's very prog.
Very prog.
Hold on to your hats.
Awesome.
Hold on to your hats. I mean, I have some really unbelievable musicians playing on this. My guitar, Tommy Calvin, who played on 1,000 Hands on the tour. Jim Gentry is sort of in the Steve Morris kind of world.
Sure.
That kind of world. My brother on bass is just amazing. And so I got Billy Cobham on drums.
Yep.
Billy Ashball from Moody Blues on drums.
Awesome.
Matt Brown on drums, who's my studio engineer and a fantastic drummer and engineer. And a lot of times, after I get somebody on the thing, I sort of have kicked off other people, put Matt on it, because he knows where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And then see Liberty DeVito, a longtime friend of mine who plays on all the Billy Joel hits.
Right.
He's on there. Chick LaVell from the Stones is a very close friend of mine. He's playing piano on a cut. Mm-hmm. A couple other people that are supposed to play on it that haven't sent me the parts, so I don't want to say in case something happens.
Right.
And they don't play. But, so it's that. It's a pretty, and it's got orchestra pieces and rock pieces, sort of fusion-ish type, very, very, digital.
When do you think it'll be out?
Well, I think we're going to go into probably February. I think we're going to do pre-sale.
Okay.
I think I want to, it's probably going to come out about May because we're anticipating our tour is going to be July. So I think I want to have it come out, you know, just a couple months before the tour. We will play, of course, some of the pieces on the tour, plus some tunes Robbie's associated with. You know, I mean, you're not going to get, be able to do a Robbie Steinhardt and the Music of Kansas mm-hmm. without playing some Kansas stuff.
Right, right.
But I do have the people who can nail the Kansas stuff. And, it sounds great. Our first rehearsals were wonderful. Looking forward to it. And, yeah, it's going to be great.
Well, I'd like to get you and Robbie, back on the show once the album's out, you know?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that would be good. I think sometime just prior to release.
Okay.
You know, because I'll tell you what, when you see, when you hear the album, and I will, you know, just prior to release, I will send you the album.
Okay.
And when you see the artwork and mm-hmm. everything that goes along with it, which is a concept, I think you'll really be on board.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that, because, you know, it's about time Robbie has, you know, something out there, you know. I know it's association.
Yeah, it's taken him a while, you know. I mean, he sent me a bunch of violin parts and stuff, and
right.
I started working from some ideas that he had, and then my brother and I, with him, and, you know, started working on some songs, and, so they've all taken shape, and it all has a purpose. It's not just a bunch of songs. It all has a reason for the songs. It's all sort of a, you know, an opera, in a sense.
Kind of a concept, rock
it's all,
opera.
It's all about, you know, basically
good.
Robbie's beginnings and his trials and successes, his rebirth, and the whole bit. You know, it's like that.
Yeah, I'm a big Kansas fan from way back. Yeah. Have
you'll love it, because it is prog and classic rock.
Oh, I love it.
Deeply fused with some unbelievable playing.
Mm-hmm. Can't wait, man. Have you heard, do you know who Jerome Mazza is?
No, I don't.
He's got a band called Pinnacle Point, got a new album out called Symphony of Mind. The band sounds just like Kansas. I mean, he's incredible. He's got an incredible voice. As a matter of fact, he knows Robbie. They might have done some things together. I don't know. But he was also on Steve Walsh's last couple of albums.
Oh, yeah, with the Black Butterfly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But, you know, I originally, you know, I'm not sure that this should be in your interview, but I originally reached out to Steve because I wanted to do a thing with Steve. And
right.
I was just kind of disappointed that Steve, you know, he basically said, I'm retired. I mean, I don't really know. But, I mean, the guy's got probably one of the greatest voices in rock and roll, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I worked with it one time. My brother and I played a couple shows with Steve and, you know, did all the hits with just Steve.
Right.
And, but it's just that because, you know, that guy has got such a wonderful voice and such a great history and not to be doing anything at all.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem to be great. You know, it doesn't seem to be good.
He was doing a little bit, you know, with, you know, like all-star bands. Together, you know, like him and some other bands from the 70s, that kind of thing for a while, but.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I like your history with one of my heroes, Wolfman Jack. I got to meet Wolfman in DC at a Hard Rock. He was doing a show there, and I used to live in Maryland at the time, and he was on, I think it was Extra 104. He did an oldie show. In that area.
I probably was there.
Were you there?
I probably was there. You know, I mean, you know, I met Wolf a long time ago when I was doing a thing called the Holiday Star Theater in Maryville, Indiana, where I lived in Indiana
right.
for many years. And Wolf came to do a oldie show there.
Uh-huh.
And he just fell in love with the band. And so he stayed in touch with me and he said, hey, look at you know, I'm doing this thing. I'm doing it. Do this television show with me. Your band's great.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, sure, man. So we did. I did a couple of TV shows with them, and then I got an offer to come down to Florida with a company called Little Garlands back
right.
in 1986. And they were offering me a ton of money to bring the band down to back all the oldies people at Little Garlands. So I took the job because
Right.
You know. So I did. I came down and I did that gig for like 6 years and started out a TV show for the National Network called Rock and Roll Palace.
Right.
And then eventually, through my friendship with Wolf, there were some problems in there in the administration of that company, and I brought Wolf in to make it Wolfman Jack's Rock and Roll Palace in probably 1990. So Wolf was a Rock and Roll Palace for maybe, I don't know, 2 years or something.
Yeah, you know, I saw some of the videos on YouTube. I think it was you playing playing piano on with Del Shannon and the Shirelles.
Exactly. That's
yeah.
Me. And my brother playing bass.
Yeah, you guys were awesome, man.
It's amazing. You know, those things are sort of resurfacing. Well, actually, A.J. Stanton, the lawyer who owned those shows, has put them out as A.J.'s Ace Cafe or Ace Jukebox, something like that.
Right.
So, yeah, they're all over the internet now, and, you know, I don't get paid.
Oh, shit.
I'm supposed to get paid. You know, but streaming is a whole other, you know, story of music now.
Was that Rockin' Robin, the band that backed?
That was Rockin' Robin.
Okay.
Rockin' Robin originally was a five-piece band.
Right.
And moved down to Florida, and the saxophone player, who was a brilliant saxophone player, and part of, actually, sort of like the leader of the band in a way, me and him were both leads, he decided to stay up there and repair instruments.
Hmm.
So he didn't come down with us, and then it just was a four-piece, and for, 8 years, we just did that oldies thing, and it was the best college education anyone could ever have.
Definitely.
Working with a new group every week.
Yeah.
And me and Jim Gentry, who's the guitar player with the Robbie Steinhardt band.
Right.
Jim's a brilliant guitar player, and we were just laughing the other night about one day there's a band called, they gotta help me here, I'm trying to think, they had a song called South Street.
South Street.
Anyway, they came in and we were all playing each other's instruments. Everything. I was playing the bass and Tim was playing the drums and Jim was playing the piano and whatever. We weren't playing our original instruments, and they came walking in and they came right up on stage and they gave us the music and we played through a couple of their songs and they were telling us what a great band we were, and we just couldn't do it anymore. We just broke up laughing and then we all switched instruments.
Huh.
You know, like, whoa.
There was a band called the Orlines.
The Orlines.
Yeah, the Orlines. Yeah.
South Street. Right, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys, I mean, people have to check it out on YouTube, because you got, Lou Christie, one of my favorites, was on the show.
Your friend, yeah.
The Comets, I love Freddie Cannon. He was always a favorite of mine. Martha Reeves, Mary Wells, The Contours, I mean, very cool. Very, very cool. And,
yeah, thousands of stories about all those crazy people.
Yeah.
We did probably from the time I was at Holiday Star in about 1978 until about 1996. We toured off and on with all those people. Mm-hmm. Del Shannon, you know, Mary Wells, everybody. The Coasters, the Drifters, the Platters.
Love it.
You know, Roger McGuinn played the show.
Yep.
Anyway, Mitch Ryder. Question Mark and the Mysterians.
Yeah, man.
Toby Gray.
Yep.
You know, so many different people. Spencer Davis.
Yep. Who just passed away.
Yeah. Spencer was one of my very dear friends.
Uh-huh.
I was just looking at a picture the other day of him dancing with my grandma.
Really? You're kidding me.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
He was such a romancer. He asked my grandma to dance, and I had a picture of it. It was so good.
You know, Roger lives close to you. Roger McGuinn?
Yeah, he lives down the street.
Yeah.
I just did a giant orchestra version of 8 Miles High.
Really?
With Charlie DeShane from Hall & Oates playing saxophone a la John Coltrane.
Huh.
That's something I just always wanted to do.
Oh, awesome.
Then it goes into a Ravi Shankar bit.
Great tune.
That's almost finished. Yeah, like I said, but my brain needs food. I have a young 8-year-old piano virtuoso came over here last week, and I haven't been able to sleep since I heard her play.
Those guys are amazing. I don't understand. I mean, I've seen them as young as like 2 and 3 years old playing piano.
This girl's different, though.
Yeah.
She's she's Chinese. You know, my wife is Chinese, and
right.
My wife teaches exclusively Chinese kids.
Okay.
Because she can speak to them in Chinese, and a lot of the moms want some, you know, they want to keep some semblance of their culture while they're living here. But this young girl, her name is Abigail Huang, came in, and she has 400 songs memorized.
Wow.
Doesn't read on site. She plays everything from memory. She played 20 Christmas songs for a little big project she wanted to do, and I could not believe how she played. Most young virtuosos play like they can't wait for the song to get over.
Yeah.
She played with the sensibility of a 50-year-old guy.
That's amazing. You know that?
And complex inner harmonies with tiny hands. I don't see how she did it. But me and my engineer were blown away, and so I had a meeting with her mom today, and I'm going to do something with her. She's just amazing. Just, my brain needs food.
You know, I noticed that you built a recording studio, too, in Jamaica?
Well, no, I didn't build a studio in Jamaica. I went down to record the very first reggae tribute.
Okay.
In 1982, August of 82. It's Bob Marley had just died, and
right.
They had the first Sunsplash. So I went down to Jamaica, and I was going to record it. But when I got down there, the machine, the 24-track machine from Criteria in Miami, couldn't fit through the Air Jamaica doors.
Jeez.
So they called me and said we had to do something else. So through some friends, I mean the Stones recorded down in Byron Lee and the Dragonair studio in Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, I got a hold of Byron Lee. And then I rented his 24-track machine in his studio, and we went over the mountains and in a truck and took the 24-track machine and brought it over, and I spent like 2 days soldering wires to open up, you know, and then I recorded, I was soldering wires until like 2 hours before the show.
Jeez.
And then I recorded everything with, as my friend Tom Dowd, it told me.
Yep.
Add all the highs to everything, and I did that
cool.
To counteract not having a Dolby, and everything came out beautiful, and that album became Reggae Sunsplash, Warner Bros. Electro Asylum, which was nominated for Best Folk Album of the Year.
Exactly. That's awesome, man. Yeah, I spent a little time down in Montego Bay, Runaway Bay, we went to, you know, we did Dunn River Falls. Cool place.
Oh, yeah, that's beautiful down there.
Beautiful down there.
I reconnected with a couple of the people from that day. You know, the band Third World.
Great band.
Like 13 times for a Grammy, never won. So,
wow.
A while back, I got invited to their honorary Grammy. They got an honorary Grammy for being nominated 13 times and never winning. And, then too, my son is a reggae promoter around here, believe it or not. I think it has to do with, I did the reggae thing for a while, and I knew a lot of the reggae people, like, you know, the Marleys and, Peter Tosh and Dennis Brown, Culture, Inca Mouse. My son really got into it, started promoting reggae shows down here in Florida with a friend of his, and, I got a chance to introduce him to the Wailers and, you know, and Third World and stuff like that. So, you know, whatever.
We have a local reggae band that plays around here called Democracy.
Yeah?
Yeah. They perform, like, small clubs and things like that. But they're very, very good. Excellent.
I have an album that my drummer, engineer Matt Brown, produced an album by a band here called Horizon.
Horizon?
And the album
Horizon.
Is magnificent.
Really?
I did some, keyboards on it and some arrangements, and then Matt virtually produced that whole project because I was away in China.
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta say, it's fantastic. The singer in that band, his name is Zach Wolfgram.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know Wolfgram. Leilani Wolfgram is the herbivore girl.
Right.
Yeah, anyway, that's her brother.
Huh.
And Zach is the real deal. He's a real reggae deal, man. He really has that feel. idealist, but, you know, put that out, which has never come out. I was going to put it out, like, next year, I think, when my label's going to come out. So, I think it'll be out there, but it's a fantastic record, The Horizon. I don't know what they're going to call the record, but, really great record.
Yeah, we need more reggae, you know? It's kind of quiet down around here anyway.
Well, I mean, there's just, sort of, in the clubs and everything, there's just sort of a lull in any kind of originality.
Right.
I remember coming into my studio one time when I was back on one of my trips from China, and I went in, there's a famous producer in my studio with a band and they're recording. I said, you know, because sometimes the studio got booked, I didn't even know who was in there. So, hey man, what are you doing? So yeah, well look, I'm trying to make this band like 10% Dashboard Confessional, and 10% Nickelback, and 10%, man, why don't you just let it be something unique than, you know, trying to make it, you know, something that's, you know, a derivative of
right,
something.
Right.
You know, if you look back at the 70s, all the bands were so different.
Yep.
I mean, the Eagles, Jethro Tull, Chicago.
Yes.
But everything was just like, they weren't so close together.
Right.
Sometimes you don't know who's who.
Yeah.
You know, they're all trying to, well, that song's a hit, so I'm trying to do it like that. I'm just in a song, and I'm just trying to, actually, for me, I'm just trying to make it sound as different as I can.
Sure.
Where haven't I gone? I don't want to ruin the song, but where can I go to make the song special?
Exactly.
You know, I have a songwriter friend. He gave me a bunch of songs, and I recorded this blues singer down here that I really like, and he said he didn't like the way she did the song. I said, you can always do the song your way, but that's her version of your song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like she's doing your song. You're getting royalties for her song.
Right, right.
You're like getting in a taxi and telling the taxi driver, I want to go here. And he says, no, I don't want to go there. Just like that. No. So.
I did, I don't know if you know Brian Bromberg, jazz guy. He did an album of all, you know, Jimi Hendrix classics, but only using bass, with different kinds of bass, and it is phenomenal. It sounds so different, but it's you know, just various bass guitars.
You know, my brother is such a great bass player. I told him the other day, I said, look, I want you to do some original songs, but I want you to do it all on the bass.
Right.
Everything on the bass.
Yeah.
And he can make so many unique sounds on the bass. I mean, he can play like Jaco. He's always been able to play like, he plays fretless bass, he plays string bass, he plays stick. You know, he's really gifted. Technically gifted. And my brother played jazz standards almost every night. For like 15 years.
Right.
Different piano player every night.
Sure.
Different keys, different arrangements. And I remember when he was playing with Larry Coryell on a break, on a concert, Larry was telling, hey Tim, I want to play, Moonlight Roman or something, something in Paris, Springtime in Paris.
Right.
And Tim says, well, can you do it in? He goes, yeah, and then Tim started playing, he goes, and Larry, oh, I like your changes. Tim said after, he goes, I played this song so many different ways. I don't know what the right way is. I just know the way I like it. So they worked it up on the break, and they went out and played it. It was beautiful.
Mm.
It was just the two of them. Larry was amazing. I love Larry.
Oh, yeah. All those guys. Does he play the stand-up bass as well? Your brother?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
He's got three historic basses. He's got a bass that's 250 years old.
Wow.
He's got one that's 100 years old. He's got one that's 50 years old. It's an English bass, German bass, and a Czech bass.
That's cool. That is so awesome.
Six different electric basses and an 8-string bass, and I mean, he's got everything. He's got everything you could possibly imagine, and he knows how to use them all.
Yeah, I'm a big jazz fan as well. You know, love jazz.
Well, you know, we've done our jazz thing. We have a jazz fusion album that we have that put out. It's got Tower Power and a bunch of different
things on
it. You know, we haven't put it out because I was too busy. I didn't want to flood the market with a bunch of different products. You know, it's time will come.
Yeah.
You know, whether I put it out for free or not, you know, it's just, but, you know, jazz is what we learned jazz. We played jazz for a long time. We had jazz bands. And then we fell back into the rock and roll with the attitude that we could play jazz.
But didn't you have a kind of a weird or funny Dave Brubeck story I heard?
How'd you hear that?
I don't know. I read it somewhere. Is that true?
Yeah, this is pretty bizarre. You know, I was doing a concert up in Kalamazoo, Michigan with my band. The band was called Saint Bernard.
Right.
And we had, our stuff was sort of like, I don't know, King Crimson, or it was more like Uriah Heep.
Oh, cool.
I gotta say that. It was like Uriah Heep. We had really great vocals, B3, electric piano, and the vocals were really good. I can't even remember any of the stuff we played on our first album, and I don't have a copy of it. I've been searching for a copy for years. Anyway, so we're playing, and part of the show was me, I'm all dressed up. Actually, if you see the picture, I look exactly like Patrick Moraz. I had Patrick Moraz haircut, great big sideburns, and I was wearing a silver glitter suit.
Huh.
Right?
Right.
Now, I had been playing jazz.
Uh-huh.
I was going to the conservatory, American Conservatory, and I was playing jazz, and I knew, like, some of the Dave Brubeck stuff, like, you know, Take Five, and Blind to All the Turk, and all the stuff, and, you know, I learned all the standards, you know, Night in Tunisia, and Giant Steps, and all the stuff, but I was really into jazz. But my living was, I was a young white guy, I gotta play rock to make a living, and there's no chicks that want to go out with me when you're a jazz guy, they want to go out with a rock guy.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I'm playing in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and all of a sudden, I see out in the audience, it's my time to, there's Dave Brubeck and his two sons out there. They're playing a concert that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to go to the concert, but I had to play the gig. So they had just finished their concert. After the concert, they came into the thing, and they sat down there and I'll watch it. And then it came time for me to do part of my show, which was to put the smoke bomb in the back of my Mini Moke. And so I'm playing, and I was trying to quote some Brubeck stuff. You know, in 4/4, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I'm thinking, I'm looking at him, and he's sort of looking at me like, yeah, I get it. And then it came time for me to put the smoke bomb in the back of the Mini Moke, and then they just looked at each other, and they got up, and the look on their face was disgust, and they shrugged their shoulders and off. You know.
Oh, well.
Whatever. I couldn't take a joke.
I know. Whatever. It's funny.
But, you know, being around as many years as we have in all the shows that we've played, you know, my brother's been kind of, he said, you know, we ought to write a book.
You should.
He corroborates all the stuff that people think that I'm saying is bullshit.
Uh-huh.
It's not.
Yeah.
He'll corroborate and say, oh, you know, you're a little bit wrong in that. I mean, yeah, some of the stuff I've got in my mind of what happened, but we have stories of almost every famous artist, you know.
If you ever need a ghostwriter, let me know. I just put out my third book, and it's full of interviews that I've done for the last 10, 15 years.
Well, you know, sometimes, you know, you think of me and my story isn't that interesting, but as I sit down to talk with people, like, one, for instance, like Robbie, I sit down and talk with Robbie.
Sure.
And I'm intrigued by his stories because he's kind of one of those guys, he doesn't really tell you much. You got to sort of pry it out of him.
Right.
Me, all my stories are either funny or exciting, so I tell it when I get a chance, you know, because it was my life.
Yep.
Right? And they all say, hey, man, you ought to write a book. You should really write a book because, I mean, my career goes back to, like, I've worked with so many people.
Well, the main thing is you got to remember everything. You know, jot down memories just to make sure, you know, you'll still remember. Keep a diary, and if you have pictures, that's a big plus, you know?
Yeah, I got a lot of the pictures. A guy wanted me to do a show, actually down your way. there's a friend of mine who's a Buddy Holly impersonator.
Okay.
And he does a show down at a place called Vistana, which is down next to you. It's a little coffee house.
Right.
Dinner theater.
Right.
And he was searching for a piano player to play his Buddy Holly show one time. And so he called me up and said, "Hey, Mike, do you know anybody who would come down to play my Buddy Holly show? I need somebody, you know, I don't have anybody, my piano player's sick." And I said, "Hey, Sean," I said, "you know, I'll come down to do it." I mean, I was looking, actually, that's the weekend I went down to see Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, "Okay, look, I'll tell you what, I'll go down, you gotta get me a hotel room, though." And he said, "No problem." So he got me a hotel room, and he got me a little bit of dough, and me and Nana drove down there, and I played the show. Well, as he's introducing the show, he's saying, "And ladies and gentlemen, the guy that's on piano tonight, we're going to play this next song by Del Shannon. He worked with Del Shannon many, many times. And Michael, tell me something about Del Shannon." So I told him Del Shannon story. And people, "Oh, oh, oh." Then we went on to the next song. You know, it went on and on like that for the whole evening. You know, and the guys in the band encouraged Sean to do it. And Sean was encouraged by the audience to do it. And we told stories about all these different artists that I worked with.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy from the theater said, "Hey, why don't you come back and bring that guy back and have him tell stories of all the people he played with?" So, I mean, they never got it together, but I just thought, you know, there's a lot of guys like me who have played with a lot of different people, and they have a lot of stories.
Exactly.
But,
yeah.
You know, working with all those artists, you know, some guys, it's like, you know, you had a really great experience. Like, you know, I had a really great experience with the Stones, really great experience with the guys in Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's the funny stuff I can tell. Sometimes I'm scared to say it, you know, I mean, like, I had the greatest conversation one time with Chris Squire. I mean, I was almost peeing my pants, it was so funny, some of the stuff he was saying.
Yeah.
But he was a very funny guy.
Yeah, he was funny, yeah, very funny. John Anderson, he had some great stories for me, too, you know. One of them was, he got on an airplane, and the plane was headed towards the wrong direction, and one of them stood up and said, "Excuse me, can you turn the airplane around?"
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, the guy that's really funny is Rick Wakeman. he's
well, you know, Tim and I toured with Rick in England.
Right.
It was me, Tim, and a drum machine.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And we toured around doing, you know, I was a chord clinician.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I went over to England and played at British Music Fair. Just me and a drum machine, and they would provide me all the keyboards. My good dear friend, who was originally my roadie in England, Rob Castle, became the head of Chord UK. You know, 20 years later, he became the head of Chord UK. So he was my roadie when we were doing the Wakeman thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we would, I had a shirt that I spilled coffee on. And what happened was I would made a map of England on it, and my brother and I, when we would go to see a stone or an abbey or some historical thing which we're into, we would put it on the map. And that was all on the front where I spilled the coffee. On the back was the punchline to all Wakeman's jokes.
Right.
So we never told the joke, we just told the punchline. Because I heard the joke so many times. You know.
Yeah.
So on the back of the shirt, Rick would saw it, he would laugh, you know. But, you know, Rick's Rick. You know, he can be the greatest guy in the world, or, woo, he can be, you know, different.
I got him on a good day, I guess.
Yeah. No, he's a brilliant guy, piano player, and he's a funny, funny guy.
Yeah.
Just sometimes, you know, I don't know, I should scrap all that.
Yeah, right.
Please.
But he, you know, we were talking about, you know, he was on Grumpy Old Men, you know, in England.
Yeah.
TV show, you know, and then he used some of that material for the, when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, he was very funny during that speech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think any of the other guys appreciated it, but, you know, I think it made a lot of news for sure.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
It was all good for Rick. But I don't think the other guys in the band really appreciated taking their Rock and Roll Hall of Fame type speech there.
Yeah. I didn't realize. He told me that Yes fought a lot. I didn't realize that they did fight a lot.
Well,
yeah.
Believe me, I have known these guys since 1980.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yep.
And there's no love lost between any of them.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, the thing is, it's just like a lot of bands. I mean, I was there when the Stones were fighting, and now they all love each other.
Yeah.
Some of them have the capability to forget all that stuff, and, you know, you're young and, you know, and egotistical and not realizing that it's all the chemistry of between you all that made it work.
Right.
So, whatever. I mean, yes, I see, just like in any band, they have their egos and how they want their life to go, but really together they made, you know, incredible music, and they got to appreciate that fact.
Well, listen, you know, they spent a lot of time together. I mean, even family yells and screams at each other. That's normal.
I mean, I reached out to Steve to play on 1000 Hands.
Right.
You know, I mean, through John's lawyer, Steve's lawyer, I had the one tune. I said, I mean, great if Steve played on. I mean, I got Alan, I got Chris, I got Rick, who's on Chapter 2.
Right.
I have Trevor, who says on Chapter 2. I don't know if I should say any of that, though. But anyway, I just said, it would be so great, because this is the classical guitar player playing on the tune. And I just reached out to through Russell, I reached out to Steve and said, hey, man, you know, it'd be really great if you played on this. And then he did.
Mm-hmm.
And then John got it, and he said, who's that? So that's Steve. He was, like, amazed.
Hmm.
You know, and then Steve, then he put words on it. And the words are very, very sentimental about how he'd like to work with Steve again, so you never know. I mean, those guys have a long history. They're like family.
Right.
You know, but, you know, who knows how it'll go. I don't want to disparage any of them, but, you know, they are grown-ups, and they all have their things, and the money and family, and their wives telling them what to do and whatever. So.
Well, I told Chris how upset I was when they dumped John. I did tell him that. I said, man,
when you dumped what?
I told Chris Squire how upset I was when they dumped John Anderson from the band, you know, because he he was sick. He went through some hard times, you know. He almost died, the guy. And to bring in a guy, you know, a tribute, you know, singer really pissed me off. You know, you got to realize, you know, when you're a Yes fanatic from day one and you followed him from the very beginning, I mean, you take it to heart, you know.
Yeah. So what did he say?
He says he was just one of those things, you know.
That's what you have to say.
Yeah.
All I ask out of you, Ray, on this interview is just anything. If I said anything that's disparaging about anybody, don't put it in.
No, I haven't heard anything yet.
Well, I've had some bones to pick with Rick over the years,
right.
You know, but I leave it alone.
Yeah.
And last time I saw Rick, I got a really nice picture of me and him.
Right.
I'm the only two times that Patrick and Rick have ever been together, I've been there.
Right.
Enforced it. You know.
You must know Billy. You know Billy too, right, Sherwood?
You know what? I don't know Billy.
Really?
The only way I would have known Billy is that Larry Coryell was doing another recording in my studio. It was the tribute to the Doors. And I talked to Billy on the phone for a few minutes, not knowing who I was, just knowing I was with the studio, about what he needed to do with Larry. You know, that's it. I never met him.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had a reason to. I mean, he's a good musician all the way around. He plays everything.
Right.
You know, he's a quintessential classic rock musician. But I've never had any reason to use him, to talk to him, or anything. Okay, we're never crossed paths in that way.
He's a good producer, you know, he makes a lot, he does a lot of collaborations, and, you know, he's a good guy.
Yeah, I mean,
good guy.
He's got my respect, he's in there, I mean, he's a bass player for Yes.
Right.
You know, but, I just never had any reason.
Right.
Or any opportunity, I'll say, to get together with him. You know, I like working with everybody. I have worked with musicians I don't really like, and then I end up liking.
Right.
Well,
Michael, here's your final question, okay?
Okay.
If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
It wouldn't be one person.
Okay, that's fine. You could be a whole band.
It would be working with Joni Mitchell.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yeah, I'd be working with Joni Mitchell, helping me write the songs. It would be Jimi Hendrix on guitar.
Okay.
It would be probably Jaco Pastorius on bass.
Right.
It'd probably be Billy Cobham on drums.
Yeah, I love Billy.
And if I could, and then the Bulgarian Voices would be my choir.
Yeah, that's a very good answer.
You know, in this day and age, it's hard to say who's your favorite, but you know what happens? It comes down to where I think about the people in your past that actually propelled you into what you do.
Right, right.
John definitely is one of them.
Okay.
I mean, I think, you know, Yes was big, but mm-hmm. Elias the Sun Hill was something I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
My sister was really into Joni Mitchell, and I was a rocker and a jazzer, and I never thought that I'd ever be into it. But at some point in my life, I think I had some sort of a lull. She turned me on to the album called For the Roses,
uh-huh.
and where Joni started playing piano.
Right.
And it just blew my mind about how simplistic what she was playing was, but how great it sounded.
Right, right.
With, you know, putting chords in the bass and stuff, which was very classical rock. And I always come back to listening to Hendrix because mm-hmm. I have a scene in my mind that I've seen a million times where I met Hendrix, and you know, and it's just always in my mind forever. You know, and for years, you know, I wanted to find a way to corroborate that meeting, and I finally found my original guitar player and my original bass player. And we got together because of Facebook. Mm-hmm. Facebook's, you know, wonderful for all the old people.
Sure.
and we started talking about it, and they remembered it exactly the way I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt vindicated, and I had some pictures I put up there with the Polaroid, and Jimmy playing the guitar with his teeth.
Yeah.
And everything, and we were waiting for my mom to pick us up from War Memorial Auditorium in Buffalo, New York. And we were walking around and around the circle, because it's like one of those theaters that the outside goes around.
Right, right.
Walking around, and, you know, my mom, we had lived before cell phones, so, you know, we just had to figure out, we don't know where she's at. So we're walking around, and man, there they were, Mitch Mitchell, Will Redding, and Jimi Hendrix having a cigarette. Next to all is they're putting the five pieces of equipment in the van, you know.
God.
And if you see the speakers that they had, they were like two EV 18s on each side.
Right.
That was it. You know? So, all the equipment went into like one truck.
Yeah.
You know? And we went up to him and, you know, he was there smoking a cigarette. He said, man, you were so great and all this stuff. You know, he's, yeah, man. Yeah, I dig it. You know? So I said, Larry, what did he say? He said, yeah, man, thanks so much. I dig it. I said, that's what I thought he said. You know?
That's awesome.
Yeah. You know, yeah. That part of us, our past, is always us.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so some of us and so many young people, like, you know, my daughter, okay, she's got a, I bought her a Nano, what was it, like a little iPod Nano?
Right, right.
It's like 10 years ago. I bought a little iPod Nano and she took, like, the bees from my database, you know, the Beatles,
uh-huh.
Beach Boys,
uh-huh.
and the Birds. So she's a big Beatles fan. Knows everything about the Beatles. She's met the Beach Boys. She's been on stage with the Beach Boys. I've known the Beach Boys for years.
Right.
So she's been on stage with them singing Barbara Ann and all this kind of stuff. So we're at a sushi bar when I'm back from China one time. We're at a sushi bar and I'm talking Japanese to the chef, right? And, you know, told him I'm a musician and all this stuff in Japanese. And, yeah. And then some people sat next to us. And then the chef was telling him, oh, yeah, this guy over here is a musician. And I looked over. It's Roger McGuinn and Camilla. Hi, Michael. And my daughter immediately recognized who Roger was.
Oh, awesome. That's great.
You know, and yeah. I said, Roger, believe it or not, she knows who you are. She was laughing about it. So he invited her to come over to his house and see some pictures of the Beatles that no one has ever seen. He's a good guy.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I took my daughter to a lot of shows that I covered. You know, like Joan Jett, and we went to a benefit show because, you know, Dickie Betts lives here in Sarasota.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I was down there for Dickie's rehearsal last year.
Yep. And now he's officially retired.
Yeah. Yeah, his manager is a very good friend of mine.
Yep.
David Spiro.
David Spiro, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So David invited me to come down to Clearwater, or Sarasota, mm-hmm. at that bar. To see the very first show, rehearsal before they went on the road.
Yep. And he played with, what was he called? Great Southern?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his son and...
Oh, yeah. His son's doing... Great. Yeah, his son's doing really well. He's a great...
Yeah, it's all good.
Excellent guitar player, also.
So with all the stuff you got, you think you make me sound good?
I think so. I think so. Michael's
there... Let me know, buddy, if you ever get up to Orlando.
Yeah.
We can have a chat.
Sure.
And it sounds like you know your classic rock.
Well, I've interviewed thousands of people. Music has been my life since I was a kid, you know.
Are you a player?
I play some guitar. Yep. Yeah. But, Mike Panera asked me if I wanted to jam with him. I said, are you kidding me? Hell no.
Yeah, I produced an album for Panera. That's one story I really don't want to tell you.
Okay, well, I was friends with Joe Lala. Do you know Joe?
I knew Joe. And yep. Joe was a great guy.
Good guy.
I played a little bit with Joe.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did an album for Mike about, 2000 and, I want to say 2014.
Right.
I think I did an album. I did a giant bang up album for Mike. Threw Mike out here. Put Mike up. He was living on somebody's couch.
Yeah, it sounds like him.
and I did an album, and I put the Jonathan Cain from Journey on it, Pat Travers, a bunch of really good people on it. Did an orchestra the whole bit. And then he was so destitute that he went to a record company and sold the demos of my album to the record company for $5,000.
Yeah. I heard some stuff about that as well.
And then I got a hold of a record company, and they're a really good record company, and I just told them, you gotta stop, because you don't have the rights to it.
Yeah.
And I can't sue Mike, because Mike doesn't have a pot to piss in.
I know.
But I'm not gonna sue you, because I know you thought you were trying to do the guy good.
Yeah.
So, they never released the record. I'm gonna release the record next year. It's gonna be called The Music of Blues Image, featuring Mike Panero.
Mm-hmm.
I have a contract for that, but I put more money into the project than I originally wanted to, and Mike was supposed to come back and re-sign the contract because I gave him more money and more money.
Right.
And I spent a lot of time on the record. The record is amazing when you hear it.
What's the name of the record?
Well, originally it was going to be called Blues Image, Next Voyage.
Okay.
I had a famous artist do a painting for it,
uh-huh.
for the album cover. And we were all on board, and then I didn't hear from Mike for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I flew Mike and his wife here. I took them around. You know, and I've been playing with Blues Image for 25 years.
Really?
Yeah, I got Mike back. I have a video of me and Wolfman Jack introducing Mike on the show the very first time I worked with him doing Ride, Captain Ride.
Hmm.
But, you know, Mike was up to some of it. I mean, his voice sounded like it, but he couldn't play the solo again in Ride, Captain Ride. He didn't play the solo on the record to begin with. Ken Hartley played that solo.
Right.
Mike never played the solo.
Right.
He couldn't play the solo, so I had to call him a session guy to play the solo.
Huh. I remember, it was, what's his name? John Byner. Did you see that YouTube where they're playing Ride, Captain Ride? But they had somebody else singing the lead, and Mike wasn't there, because I think he already, you know, got the gig with Iron Butterfly. But they had but it was his voice with somebody else singing it on that show.
Well, it's really sad, because, you know, like, I'm friends with Ron Bushy,
mm-hmm.
and the existing Iron Butterfly,
right.
And I'm actually sort of like an active member of the band, you know.
Really? That's cool.
Martin Gershowitz is the keyboard player in the band. But Martin lives in Germany, and a lot of times he can't make the gigs, so I play the gigs a lot. And I'm good friends with all the guys. They cannot tolerate Mike.
Really?
You know, very first gig I played with Mike, you know, before with Iron Butterfly, he was supposed to get Ron Bushy a commission. He never did.
Hmm.
And that was the end of him playing with Iron Butterfly for the 13th time.
Yeah, I've heard some stuff. Joe told me a couple of things, too.
You know, Mike is a brilliant player.
Yeah.
But he's got a lot of demons.
Right.
And he can't tell the truth for anything. So, I was his friend, and I was his friend all the way up until he screwed me like 5 times.
Oh, gosh.
But I couldn't do anymore. But the album is impeccable.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear it if it ever comes out.
Well, like I say, Solar Music is going to have its own label after the first year, probably by February, when I come out with pre-sale for Robbie. And then many, many products are going to be on there that you've never heard before.
Right.
You know, so, and then too, with that, I'll be doing some other artists that need to come out and do their last hurrah in a big way. And that's what I'm all about. I'm find an artist I think is deserving.
Mm-hmm.
Of having something, and I call in the troops to help him out, and if he's a nice guy, everybody helps him out. If not, I can't get anybody to help me.
Yeah.
No.
Well, I got a hotline to all these musicians as well. I mean, I put together people like you do, because they, you know, I said, have you talked to so-and-so for, oh, I haven't talked to him in 15 years. I said, well, you want to hook up with them again? Because, you know, I've got everybody's, you know, email address, and I talk to everybody. It's amazing how many people don't talk to each other.
It's going to die, so
okay. Okay.
Anyway, if it does, you call me back anytime tomorrow.
No problem. We got plenty,
Michael. I do appreciate the call.
Sure.
And I think you'd be very incremental in helping me out with launching Robbie, because you're local.
Right.
And we want to get people like you involved.
Oh, definitely. I appreciate that. And, you know, next time you're in this area, you know, seeing Patrick, let me know. I'll go, you know, I'd love to see Patrick.
Great. Do a good job of this interview and don't make me sound like a dick. I'm not.
All right, Michael. Thank you so much, man, for being on the show. I appreciate
it. Thanks, Phil. Appreciate it, Ray.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For more information about Michael Franklin, visit www.conventionmusic.com, www.michaelfranklin.com, for Alvaro Ortega, www.alvaroortega.com, and you can also purchase the Yes Legend John Anderson's release, 1,000 Hands, produced by Michael Franklin, at amazon.com. Very special thanks today to the great Billy James of Glass Onion PR for arranging this interview with Michael Franklin. And, of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. And let's see now. Yep, it's real news, people. My new book is out. It'll make a great holiday present. It's called The Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1. Chronicles Truths, Confessions, and Wisdom from the Music Legends That Set Us All Free. You can order yours today now on hardcover, the collector's edition hardcover, or ebook at bookbaby.com and also at amazon.com. Thank you for joining us. We will see you next time on Interviewing the Legends. Stay safe and healthy. Bye-bye now.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.